Good morning. Good morning. My name's Polly Pistol, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome. And thank you for welcoming us. Let me just kind of give you a rundown today of what we're going to do. And I'm not going to do anything for the first part of the morning, but I just wanted you to meet me and know that I'm with him. Since he talked last night and he's going to talk for an hour this morning, I wanted to say good morning before I get up here and say, hi, I'm here too. What we're going to do is about 11 o'clock, we're going to take a break for 10 minutes, and then at 12, we'll break for lunch. And this morning, Dave is going to give kind of an overview of the history of Alcoholics Anonymous and kind of show you why the traditions are so important. And then what we're going to do the rest of the day is that we will do the traditions. We'll take a tradition like tradition one, and we'll talk about the tradition, and then we'll talk about how that tradition applies to relationships. And if you're not in a marriage or in a committed relationship, it can work in any kind of relationship. Family relationships, job relationships, any type of relationships. The traditions are given to us so that they can show us how to get along with each other. The steps teach me how to get along with me, and the traditions teach us how to get along with each other. And it works in marriages, parents, jobs, whatever, friends. So that's kind of a rundown of what we're going to do this morning, or today, all of today. And first, I'm going to introduce you to Dave. Most of you heard him last night. And he's going to give us an overview of the history of Alcoholics Anonymous and how the traditions came to be. Okay, Dave.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Dave. I'm an alcoholic. I want to welcome all of you here, all those of you from NA and SLAA and Al-Anon and GA, although I don't think we have any yet from GA. Did I leave anybody out? Anyway, whatever your affiliation, we're very glad you're here, and we hope you're glad you're here. I would like to start this morning with a prayer I got from a Catholic priest at an AA convention in California about 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years ago. And he had written this prayer. His name was Father John M. And he had written this prayer, and it just really touched me. And I went up to tell him after the meeting that, you know, that I had really been touched by his prayer. And he said, it's yours. And he gave it to me. And so I use it. And that reminds me, before I start the prayer, to let you know that this prayer, we use some notes when we do this workshop, so we can stay focused and stay on the subject and not wander off into something else. And so these notes, which you don't need, we don't usually follow them anyway. They have all the they have the essence of what we're going to say in them, but I am going to send the prayer that we're going to use and the notes and all kinds of other stuff to somebody here, probably Aner, and they're going to put it on the website. So those of you who know about the website, CPH12 is the website, and if you don't understand what I'm saying right now, anybody with one of those white badges on can tell you if you need more information. But I just wanted you to know that way, you know, otherwise we have to carry around a big suitcase full of copies. And one of two things always happens. We have too many or we don't have enough. And so that's the way we'll do it. So you're all welcome to have it, and I intend to send that to him as soon as I get back, which will be about a week and a half or 2 weeks. And he and Aner says it will be on the website within a couple of days after he gets it. So it won't be too long, probably about 2 weeks, and it should be up there. Okay, so the prayer that I want to start with is entitled Gracias. God, I know you aren't necessarily impressed and certainly not fooled by my appearance here, but let me invoke you now to remember why I go to meetings. I address you. Power of breathing, power of life, my higher power, heart of my heart, you have done remarkable things, new, astonishing deeds of power, and yet so much is left undone. Let me breathe this bit of unfinished freedom before I begin my appeal for breath and heartbeat, a place to stand and language to complain. Thank you. Now that I am breathing in and out, should I simply stand here till you come? How should I await your always late arrival? My family's not perfected. Utopia is betrayed, and still I should thank you for making me wait, to worry and wonder why so much is yet undone. Ossie says, if you pray, don't worry. If you worry, don't pray. No point in doing both. You know I am unknown, and you simply are everywhere. Everywhere you are known in the wonder of these gatherings of brothers and sisters of the Spirit. In our meetings, you have promised to make us known to ourselves. Perhaps that's why I stay away sometimes, or learn to report on how I've handled the near past, where you aren't, instead of the near flammable present, where you are. Where breathing and standing interrupt my thinking and clear a space in the unkempt warehouse of my soul, I wonder if you'll set me afire again. I'm afraid you won't. But then the blessing is invoked when we call our names and ritually identify the soul sickness and know a new thanksgiving. I'm pulled again beyond my thoughts to live in this moment of undeserved, unearned grace. Gracias, grace. Gracias for undeserved grace. Gracias por tus dones. Gracias por mi vida, mi amor. Dios de mi corazón. Amen. Okay, here's what we're going to do. Tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them. We're going to talk about some characteristics of Alcoholics Anonymous and the other programs that are represented here. And then we're going to talk a little bit about a very brief history so we get some sense of what led up to AA and 12-step programs in general. And then what happened to us? So the first thing that I want to do is tell you that most of what we're going to be sharing today is based on our personal adventures both before and since our marriage. And so what we want to share with you is what actually happened, okay? What happened to us, what we did, as opposed to what we think you should do. The emphasis is on our experience rather than our opinion of what you should do. You know, it's a funny thing. If I talk to you about you, you get angry and defensive. At least if you talk to me about me, that's what I do. But if I talk to you about me, I give you an opportunity to quietly think in your own mind, oh, I do that too. And you don't have to admit anything out loud. what was the problem? Polly and I were married on October the 27th of 1980. And each of us believes that we have the most wonderful mate in the whole wide world. And I hope you feel that way about the people with whom you have relationships, whether they're children or marriage partners or girlfriends or boyfriends or whatever, or just friends. However, I am not Polly's first husband, and she is not my first wife. I had three marriages before Polly, all ending in abysmal failure. There were no smiles and friendly handshakes when they split up. And as one of our Al-Anon friends likes to point out to me, Dave, you were the only common thread in all three failures. Smart alecky Al-Anon. So what happens is they just inexorably ground down to just dreary failure. Just dreary failure, you know, where everybody walks away feeling bad and nobody's happy and all of that. And, you know, and I look back and say, well, you know, well, what was the problem? You know, what was the problem? And the problem from my vantage point now is so easy to see, it's unbelievable. I have no idea. Well, I had a spiritual malady throughout those marriages and throughout most of my life. So I can see how I missed it. But the problem was that I was selfish and self-centered. It was all about me. And as long as I want to be selfish and self-centered, my life is not ever going to work. You know, and as I said last night, being selfish and self-centered doesn't mean you think well of yourself. It means you think only of yourself. So, you know, anytime things didn't go my way, I became restless and irritable and discontented and just fussy about my life. You know, I was just continually frustrated in my role as a husband because I didn't know what a husband was supposed to do or anything, and I didn't like to do what I thought a husband was supposed to do. And so I would evade it every time I got a chance, and my expectations were never met, you know. So what can you do about it? Well, what Polly and I tried to do about it when we began to have little problems in our marriage, and we've never had really big problems because we were both sober when we met and had been sober for a few years. But we tried some psychotherapy as a couple. And, you know, we wanted to be on the fast track to realized ultimate reality marriage. You know, somehow we get the idea that, you know, it's just obsessive compulsive alcoholic thinking. You know, if here is a path, a process called Alcoholics Anonymous and we can proceed along this path at a reasonable pace, and our lives will come into order. Perhaps if we went faster or took a shortcut, we could get there sooner. I mean, does that sound like the kind of thinking that we do? So we just came to understand that there is no fast track, you know. Therapy, you know, our experience with the therapy that we tried to do was good for information purposes, but it didn't really heal us. It helped us understand ourselves better, but it didn't really heal any problems. It did not produce a psychic change. And, psychotherapy, we believe, in our case, it informed us, but it did not heal us. God healed us. And so it was occasionally helpful, but Alcoholics Anonymous has been indispensable. So I want to talk a little bit now about... So in other words, my point being that, it is sometimes helpful... In fact, I want to stop and make this point. It is sometimes helpful to have a third party, if you're having relationship problems, to kind of, you know, keep a lid on things. Polly and I have in the past sponsored women and men who happen to be married to each other. And we found that they would have an argument, and the wife would call Polly and tell her what the argument was about and what happened. And the husband would call me and tell me what the argument was about and what happened. And Polly and I would talk to each other, and it's like we were talking about two entirely different couples. The stories were nothing alike. The facts were nothing alike. And this one couple in particular, we finally just told them, look, we all four have to be together in the same room at the same time, talking among ourselves before we can do any more work here. Because, you know, and see, the thing is, nobody meant to deceive. Nobody was trying to distort the truth. It's just completely different perspectives on what happened. And so, anyway, sometimes it's very helpful. So I think that is where things like therapy, for example, can play a fantastic role in your life. If you just need somebody to kind of referee things and say things like, no, when he says this, he doesn't mean what you think he means. What he means is this. And let's talk a little bit now about some characteristics of Alcoholics Anonymous and 12-step programs that are like it. AA is an inclusive organization. We are not exclusive. We look for reasons you should be here rather than ways to keep you out. We pride ourselves on saying that whenever anyone, anywhere reaches out for help, we want the hand of AA always to be there, and for that I am responsible. In the U.S., we have a very large commitment that took some time before it was formed, but we have a very large commitment that is generally referred to as hospitals and institutions. So that we take AA meetings into jails, prisons, hospitals, insane asylums, nut wards. We go to therapy places. You know, places that where they have treatment centers. We welcome people from treatment centers into our AA meetings. We do everything we can to include everybody because the founders of our program said we don't want to deny anybody an opportunity to get sober. We do not have the right to tell anybody, sorry, but we're not going to help you. We have to help everybody. And so that means is that all alcoholics are welcome as members of Alcoholics Anonymous. How do you get to be a member? You say, I'm a member. That's all. If you have a desire to stop drinking and you want to be a member, you are. And nobody can do anything about that. You know, we cannot kick you out. Okay? If you have a desire to stop drinking, there is nothing in Alcoholics Anonymous that will let us kick you out. If you come here drinking, as long as you're not disruptive, as long as you don't disrupt our meeting, you're welcome. If you have a desire to stop drinking, you're welcome. Many of us couldn't get here any other way. You know, if I can't come drinking, I can't come. And it's not just okay with us that you are here. We want you here. You know, we want you here. And so the next point is that we demand nothing. Our steps of recovery are suggested. The book says here are the steps we took which are suggested as a program of recovery. And you are free to ignore every suggestion we make within the framework of our traditions. You are free to ignore every suggestion we make without forfeiting your membership. The requirement for membership doesn't say you have to follow our suggestions. You know, and we have a lot of people who don't like the thought that the steps are suggested. But that word is in the book. You know, now my personal opinion that I have formed over the last 28 years is that I don't think you have much of a chance at all to have a happy life that you're going to enjoy living if you don't work the steps. You know, I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, I would probably have long since committed suicide if I hadn't worked the steps. You know, the fellowship is great, and it'll carry you for the first few days. Maybe the first few weeks, maybe even a little longer than that. But eventually, we have to change. And hanging around with people and shaking hands and drinking coffee and smiling and telling jokes is a lot of fun, but it does not produce a psychic change. And if you don't have a psychic change, it says so in the book. And, I refer to that book as though it were some sort of my attitude and my words referring to that book, or you might think as though someone were referring to the Holy Bible, and in my case, that's exactly how I feel about it. I have come to feel that way. I thought when I first came here, you know, you guys are just, you get a little carried away with this, don't you? You know, but I have followed what's in that book. And my life is beyond my wildest expectations. So it's not casually, you know, or without any thought that I regard that book with such high esteem. It's because it has been so true in my life. It exactly explains me how I think, what I do, and what I can do if I don't like what I think and what I can do. So our program is suggested, and you can... If you don't like our suggestions, don't take them. You know, we have a standing offer at our group. You know, you come in and hang out with us and go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and we'll save your misery in a bag over here. And if you don't like what we have to offer, we'll give you your misery back and you can go on your way. AA is free. AA is essentially free. We don't have any money, we don't have any property, and it wouldn't do us any good to have money or property because all we'd do is fight over it. We'd fight over who gets to manage it, who gets to own it, who gets to control it, who gets to say what happens to it. And, you know, we just can't do it. We cannot handle money, we cannot handle property, we cannot handle prestige. You know, that's why we're anonymous at the public level. You know, people, we don't want somebody sitting up there as a celebrity saying, gee, I used to be bad and now I'm good. And 15 minutes later they're drunk and everybody's out there saying, see, I knew Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work. So, the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous, both all the ones that I know about. There's a General Service Board in New York, but each country has its own General Service Board. As far as I know, in every country, the General Service Board owes no money. Our society owes no money to anybody. All of our bills are net 30, which means if you back your truck up and deliver a load of books to us, we give you a check when you leave, in effect. It's a net 30-day account. So... And we have an auditing firm, not affiliated with AA in any way, that audits our books, and they decide what our prudent reserve of money should be. We don't even decide that ourselves. We take their suggestion. Because we would, even in something like a prudent reserve, we'd spend the rest of our life arguing about what it should be. In addition to routine alcoholics, in AA, we have neurotics and psychotics and sociopaths and thieves and liars and cheats, all by their own admission. We have bleeding deacons and traditions lawyers. You know what a bleeding deacon is? A bleeding deacon is usually some old guy who's sitting in the back griping about that's not the way it's supposed to be done. We used to do it this way. And we don't need to change. And you know, somehow they skip over that thing in the book that says, God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Maybe they don't think God is disclosing anything to us. But, and you know what we can do about bleeding deacons? Just love them. That's all we need to do. We don't need to do anything about it. You know, people... Yet, when you look at people's motives, you know, their motive is not to, it's not anything but good. You know, maybe you feel like they're misguided or something. People who have such strong opinions and, you know, and whose attitude is, why don't you be reasonable and do it my way? But, you know, Everybody means well. So that's a bleeding deacon. Traditions lawyers are people who have a much deeper understanding of the traditions than most of the rest of us. And they are convinced that they represent the true spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they are willing to die for their way. And so we have traditions lawyers. We have an astonishing willingness to practice medicine and law and many other professions for which we have neither the education nor the credentials. But, you know, there's always somebody around that will tell you if you take this medication, you're not sober, or if you do this or if you do that, somehow you're disqualified from full or complete membership in AA. But we can't be bothered with things like education and credentials and so forth. AA has an ad hoc internal group that I call the REA, the Rules Enforcement Authority, which flies in the face of our ideas regarding no leaders but trusted servants and our inspired concept of traditions, not rules. Isn't it great that we have traditions and not rules? See, if you have rules, then violations can occur, and enforcement must follow violations. So can you imagine some kind of AA police? You know how long they'd last? You know, somebody would have to call an ambulance before 50, you know. And what this says is that these self-appointed people really feel like their sense of propriety is easily offended, and we have to do it right, and they determine what right is. And this is just the kind of people that we are. We just get that. Now, have any of you ever been to an international AA conference? Yeah, there's one back there. We call them Bill Wilson's family reunions. The last one was in Minneapolis. The next one is in Toronto in 2005. And be very careful before you go to that, because I got a feeling that if you go to one, you will never be able to not go to another one. You cannot imagine what it is like to have 50,000, 60,000 alcoholics in a major sports arena holding hands and saying a prayer together. Somebody, when you get into the sports arena, you always have to go early. And they fill all the bleacher seats, and they have chairs all over the floor of the stadium, and they're all full. And somebody always brings those great big balls, and they just get knocked around all over the arena. Balls just go flying everywhere. Everybody's laughing and smiling and hugging. There was a guy that had a truck, and he had the bed of his truck completely full of soda and ice, so that people just walking by, members of AA walking by, could have a soft drink, could have a cold drink. The energy is so good. I mean, the police think we are strange. We not only obey them, you know, when they hold up their hand for us to not walk, we not only don't walk, we make sure nobody else walks either. So, you know, if you've never been to one of those, you know, the opening ceremony at an international conference is called the flag ceremony. And every country who has a registered member is asked to present their flag at the opening flag ceremony. And they do it in alphabetical order, and, you know, from Albania to Zululand. And there are like 50, last time there were over 75 countries represented, and 75 flags were presented. And it is a very, very warm, beautiful weekend, or few days. And if at all possible for you to go, you'll have a marvelous time. You will just have a marvelous time. So, what makes all this possible? You know, what makes it possible to have a room like this where, you know, we have people who come from different places and who have different ideas about life and who have different problems and who have different levels of sobriety, who represent the entire spectrum of employment. You know, we have lawyers and doctors and garbage men and plumbers and the entire spectrum of society is an Alcoholics Anonymous. We all have a high regard for each other. We all care about each other. We all help each other. We all enjoy each other. How is that possible? How is it possible that we can do that? How is it possible that you can put 50 or 60,000 of us together in a stadium and have the kind of love and energy that is in that stadium? And that's not unusual to us. That is routine. That is typical. You know, as I said before, and we'll repeat now, you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't ever matter who the speaker is. Anybody can be a speaker. You know, all you have to do to be a speaker is get comfortable, you know, get to the point where you've lost enough fear that you can stand in front of a room full of people and talk. You know, where's the magic? Not him, not in the speaker. The magic is in us getting together. You know, that's the magic. When we get together, something really magic happens. And you can feel it and you can see it. And if you don't believe it, come up here and take a look. It's here. The magic is because we are together, and the magic is because we have a set of traditions that allow that to happen. Now, I'll tell you something. In my opinion, I like to try to identify my opinion, but in my opinion, wait a minute, I'm having a senior moment. I forgot what I always say. Yeah, I've regained myself and I've regained my composure now. In my opinion, the traditions are much, much more important than the steps. And I was aghast the first time I heard somebody say that. But they went on to explain, and I understand now and I agree, that the traditions are much more important. Because the steps allow me to personally recover from the disease I have, which is called alcoholism. If I don't work the steps, I get drunk. If we don't observe the traditions, we'll lose AA and we'll all get drunk. And, you know, when Bill Wilson first started putting these traditions together, why do you think he did that? He did it because everybody was arguing and began to argue and fight. In the mid-1940s, Alcoholics Anonymous in New York sent out a letter to all the groups that knew about and said and asked all those groups to please let us know what the requirements for membership are in your group. And this was long before we had any traditions. And of the groups that replied, they put together a composite list of requirements. And they looked at that list and they said, you know, look at this. Our judgment is no better than it's ever been. This is terrible. If we put this list of requirements into effect, our founders could not join. Our founders would not be eligible for membership. They don't meet the requirements. So we have the requirements because we have the traditions because we started fighting and squabbling over how we were going to do things and what we were going to do. And wouldn't you know that would happen? So now we have the traditions. And so I want to talk about a little bit now about, hopefully have made the case for having the traditions. And I want to tell you a little bit about some of the things that happened along the way before we got here. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is not the first group that ever called alcoholism a disease. There was a doctor in 1796 by the name of Benjamin Rush in the city of Philadelphia who wrote a paper that is fairly famous. I have a copy of it around here somewhere that says, you know, he referred to alcoholism as a disease. And as time went on from his definition of that, so their idea was that if we can keep people... I love this. I'm sorry this was disproved before I came along. But the idea was that as long as you drink fermented spirits, you can't become an alcoholic. Yeah, as long as you just drink beer and wine, you can't become an alcoholic. You only become an alcoholic if you start drinking hard liquor, you know, like vodka. And so a movement got started based on Dr. Rush's work called the Temperance Movement. And that finally led to the formation of a group called the Washingtonians. And this was a group of six old drunks who used to sit around in 1840 at Chase's Tavern in Baltimore. They sat around all day and drank. And one day this guy named Lyman Beecher is coming to town to give a lecture on temperance. And they decided they should check it out. So rather than all of them go, they sent a delegation. And the delegation came back to report that, this temperance really seemed like a good thing. So they decided they would form a society, and they decided it should be called the Washingtonians after rejecting a few other equally good names. And they decided they would have weekly meetings and that it would cost a nickel to join and 2.5 cents... a week after that to be a member. And so they got everybody together. They developed a pledge, a swearing off pledge, and started having meetings in Chase's Tavern. And they didn't know what to do at their meetings, so they began to tell their stories. They began to share with each other what had happened to them. And this was in 1840. And they started getting sober. And Mrs. Chase got tired of them ruining her customers. So she told them they couldn't have their Washingtonian meetings in her tavern anymore. You know, get out. But they got to be very big, very large, very popular. But they just gradually faded away. And then later on, there was a group that was formed. I'm skipping a lot of this because it's not really, all of that pertinent to what we're talking about today. But later on, the next really big group that came along was a group called the Oxford Group. And this group was formed by a guy named Frank Buckman just after the turn of the 20th century, 1927, doesn't matter, early. And it was formed in Oxford, called the Oxford Group because he was going to Oxford University at the time. And it was just a religious organization, and it was like first century Christianity is what they were after. Okay? One Christian sharing with another. No big buildings, no costumes, no liturgy. Just one alcoholic sharing with another. And the Oxford Group was very well known and was up until the mid-40s. And then it became, the name was changed along the way to NBR or something. Can't remember. But it was the Oxford Group that gave Alcoholics Anonymous most of its program. The Oxford Group had the four absolutes, and then they also had six steps to recovery. And Bill Wilson took the Oxford Group six steps and made 12 steps out of it. Sound like an alcoholic to you? Does to me. And And the point of this is that our program was not invented by Bill Wilson and Dr. Baum. When I was talking last night, I told you that a guy named Carl Jung, Dr. Carl Jung, a psychiatrist, a preeminent psychiatrist, one of the founders of contemporary psychotherapy, told a guy named Roland Hazard to go home. I can't help you. The only thing I know that can help you is some kind of religious experience. And I do not know how to induce that in you. I don't know how to make that happen. And what we have been shown in Alcoholics Anonymous, primarily because of the Oxford group and the work that they did in putting their thing together, their ideas of, you know, of one Christian sharing with another, is a way to have a spiritual awakening. Our 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result, not as a result, as the result of these steps. So we didn't invent anything here at AA. We simply adapted some principles that we got that came to us through the Oxford group, but they didn't invent them either. These are spiritual principles that we have known about for thousands of years. It's nothing new. You know, you hear people say things like, what goes around comes around. You know, and many of us believe that to be true. You know, several thousand years ago, the way it was said a couple of thousand years ago is, you're going to reap what you sow. So we didn't invent anything here. We just found a way to have a spiritual awakening. So anyway, the Oxford group gave us all of that. And we have early members of Alcoholics Anonymous used to go to Oxford group meetings all the time. In fact, the Oxford group was getting pretty annoyed with Bill Wilson because he kept bringing drunks to their meetings. You know, they said, you know, we're not an alcoholic recovery program, you know, but they were true to their faith and didn't kick anybody out. And I would like to tell you a quick little story. And in fact, I just will. Has anybody ever heard of a guy named Jim Newton? I'm going to tell you about what I think are the footprints of God. Jim Newton was a young man and lived in New York City, and he dropped in an Oxford group meeting one night looking for a girl, trying to pick up on a girl, you know, find somebody to hit on. And he was so taken with what he found there, his spirit was so touched, that he became a member of the Oxford group. And his father later, shortly after that, moved to Florida, and Jim Newton went to Florida to live with his father. Well, they lived across the street, turned out, from a man named Thomas Edison, who invented the light bulb and who's pretty well known in the world. And Thomas Edison had always had big birthday parties, and people came from all over the U.S. and Europe to go to his birthday parties. And Jim Newton lived across the street from Thomas Edison and his wife, and so he knew them, and they sort of adopted him as their son. And he would be the master of ceremonies at Thomas Edison's birthday party. And one of the guys that came to that party was a guy named Harvey Firestone. And Harvey Firestone lived in Akron, Ohio, and he was the head of the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company. So he liked Jim Newton a lot, too, so he got Jim Newton to come to Akron and go to work for him at Firestone Tire and Rubber. So he got there, and after a few years there, turned out that Harvey Firestone's son, Bud, was a very bad alcoholic. And Jim Newton said, I'll go with him to a sanitarium in New York. And it was like a 30-day treatment program. I mean, this was back in the 1930s. So it wasn't quite as refined as it is today, and it wasn't just for alcoholics, but it was a treatment program. And so Jim Newton went with Bud Firestone and stayed with him the whole 30 days because he was his friend, and helped him through this treatment program and came home with him. And at that time, Frank Buckman, who was head of the, who was still the man in charge of the Oxford Group, the head guy in the Oxford Group, was looking for a place to have a big conference, big Oxford Group convention. And Harvey Firestone, in appreciation to Jim Newton for helping his son, agreed to have to provide all the space and everything needed for the Oxford Group conference in Akron, Ohio. So the Oxford Group in New York City had found its way to Bill Wilson, and Bill Wilson, through the Oxford Group and their program, and through his friend Ebbie Thatcher and a lot of other people in the Oxford Group, Sam Shoemaker, Rowland Hazard, Seber Graves, a lot of other people. So we have the Oxford Group established in New York. Bill Wilson is in it, and Bill Wilson is sober. Jim Newton, also in the Oxford Group, but not an alcoholic, went to Florida, found his way up to Akron, Ohio, and through an act of kindness, the Oxford Group conference was brought to Akron, Ohio. And as time went by, a lady named Henrietta Seiberling and her friend, Ann Smith, Dr. Bob's wife, became members of the Oxford Group. And they would have little prayer services for Bob Smith, because he had a drinking problem. He was a drunk. Couldn't control it. And one of the people that was in the Oxford Group was a minister who had an Oxford Group-based church in Akron, Ohio. His name was Walter Tunks. And in the Mayflower Hotel in Akron, Ohio, there was a list of ministers on the wall, which used to be very common in those days. And Bill Wilson had to go to Akron, and he had some kind of hot business deal. He was a big hustler, Wall Street hustler, and he had some kind of hot business deal, and he got to Akron, and the deal fell through, and it was not going to come to fruition, and he had wasted his time and his money, and he was feeling very dejected and depressed, and he was staying in the Mayflower Hotel. And he heard all these people in a bar, the glasses were tinkling and the laughter was coming out, and he thought, maybe I should just go have one drink. But by this time, he'd been sober 6 months. And God intervened in his life, I think. Instead, he went up to this telephone and looked for the name of a minister, and he found Walter Tunks. And he said, "My name is Bill Wilson. I'm from New York. And I'm an alcoholic, and I wonder if you could tell me, I am having a really rough time, and I desperately need to talk to another alcoholic." Because by this time, he had figured out that the only way to keep what he had was to give it away. And Dr. Tong said, "I think I know somebody. Let me get back to you." He called Henrietta Seiberling. And she said, "I know somebody." She called Ann Smith. And Dr. Bob had just gotten home, drunk as a skunk. And she said, "There's a man here from New York who says he would like to talk to you about drinking. He's had a drinking problem, and he seems to be doing well with getting it under control. And he'd like to talk to you." Dr. Bob says, "No way. Not a chance. I'm not going anywhere, and I'm not talking to anybody." So she said, "Well, how about tomorrow?" Well, in true alcoholic fashion, didn't we say that all the time? Get the heat off? "Oh, yeah, tomorrow. Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. No problem. Yeah, tomorrow's great." So she told Henrietta Seiberling that they would be over to her house the next morning. The next morning, Dr. Bob woke up overhung, sick, and sorry. and said, okay, I'm going to give this guy 5 minutes, 15 minutes, and that's it. No more. So they went over to Henrietta Cyberling's house, to the gatehouse that she lived in on the Firestone Estate, and Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson went into the kitchen and had the first cup of AA coffee. And they didn't come out for 5 hours. And our program was born. And nobody's ever heard of Jim Newton. So we had the Oxford group in New York. Jim carried it to Akron, let it thrive, got a minister named Walter Tunks got into it, Ann Smith, Henrietta Cyberling. All these people were in the Oxford group. And all this was in place when Bill Wilson came to town. And to me, those are the footprints of God. You know, that's just too remarkable to believe otherwise. It is now 11 o'clock, and we're going to take a 10-minute break. Smoke cigarettes. Thank you. Okay, so what we need to have happen in life, in anything in life, and in relationships, it's no different. We have to change, okay? We have to admit to ourselves that our way does not work. Our way has not ever worked, and our way is not ever going to work. And if you think that's harsh, let me point out to you that we are all in an AA convention. If our way worked, why would we be here? So we have to do something. Change does not occur. You know, there's an old man named Chuck C. who's dead now, but he used to say, you cannot think your way into good living. You must live your way into good thinking. And so, you know, if I wait till something appeals to my better judgment, I'm going to be waiting a long time. A long time. So, if we want self-esteem, we must do esteemable things. We cannot think esteemable thoughts. You know, if we want respect, we must act in a respectable manner. If we want people to love us, we must be lovable. We must be lovable people. So, unfortunately, what that means is that we are judged by our actions and not by our thoughts or our intentions. You know, I always wanted to be judged by my intentions. My intentions were always so good. So, you know, so that's one thing. We have to change. Another thing is that we have to do what we can to let go of all of our old baggage that we have clung to for so long. You know, we all bring with us baggage. You know, emotional baggage and psychological baggage. And where do we get it? Well, we get it from our families, from our friends, from growing up. You know, many of us, probably most of us, came from homes that weren't all that great. You know, we came from dysfunctional homes. And that's not a slam at our parents. That's just simply the way things were. You know, I mean, so did they. They came from dysfunctional homes. All they did was give us what was given to them. You know, isn't that what we did with our kids? That's what I did with my kids. That's why all my marriages didn't work. I put out what I got at home. And I didn't mean to do that, but I did. So we have, you know, we have a lot of ideas about that we are willing to fight over, and they're not worth it. You know, and some of them are just silly. You know, you see arguments over how socks are folded. You know, you see arguments over whether the toilet paper should roll over the top or under the bottom. I mean, we can fight over anything, you know. How much salt should be put on the food, if any? You know, what spices should be used or not used? You know, attitudes toward institutions and churches and things like this. And it just goes on and on. A lot of us have suffered sexual abuse. Many of us have suffered a lot of emotional abuse and physical abuse. And we get to be emotionally and mentally lazy. Some of us are guilty of providing our mate with perpetual, relentless nagging about whatever they do, you know. Doesn't, if you know, and as a lady I heard one time advise some other ladies, she said, "Ladies, don't nag. It doesn't produce a desired result, and it makes you look like a bitch." Now, but we have, our mates are guilty of trying to manipulate us in different ways, and people that we have relationships with. You know, we get accused of being lazy and irresponsible, and you know, a lot of us are just critical parents who just are always, nothing is ever good enough. And there are a lot of ideas about hygiene and behavior and dress that we try to enforce on the whole world. We don't feel any compulsion to follow ourselves, but we certainly want you to. So these attitudes are things we bring with us, and we have to be willing to let them go. You know, they don't produce a desired result. It's like anger. Anger will never produce a desired result. Anger will never produce a result that you want to have. It just doesn't. Never has, never will. So, beyond all that, men and women are different. And we have to accept the differences and not try to act like we are not different. We are different. There is, for example, there is a payoff for women to talk a lot and share their feelings. They get some kind of payoff from it. If you're a man, you don't know what it is, and you're not ever going to figure it out. You're not. You know, and I don't say that in any critical sense at all. It's an observation. That's an observation. That's not a criticism. There's just some kind of payoff there that men don't get. You know, I go backpacking with the guy that I sponsor who's in the middle of a divorce, and we come home after 3 days in the woods, and she said, "What did John say about his divorce?" And I said, "I don't know, we didn't talk about it." She looks at me aghast. "You just spent 3 days together out on top of a mountain, and he's in the middle of a divorce, and you didn't talk about it?" "No." See, so it is in the nature of women to talk about things. They do not come to me wanting me to solve their problem. They just want me to listen. And I have a very hard time doing that because I am wired for problem solving. You come to me and start talking about a problem, got it. Here's what you do. And you don't like that. I don't blame you. No, I don't blame you. Please believe me, that is not a criticism. That's an observation. And if you know this in advance, Polly has learned that if she needs to talk about something, she needs to call one of her girlfriends. Don't come to me. No matter how much I try to be what you want, I cannot be. No, I cannot be. So, it's just that men and women are different. What is in the nature of men? You know, men are wired for problem solving. That's what we do. That's how we're geared. No, we don't communicate much. What is one of the primary complaints women have about men? You know, they don't tell me how they feel. They don't share their feelings. You know what? We don't have as many feelings as you do. There's not all that much to share. Thank God. You know, so you can think we're intentionally withholding something if you want to, but we just don't have as many feelings as you do, as women do. We just don't. So that is about all the teeing up I want to do, and I want to get go ahead and get started into the 12 traditions, and I'm going to turn it over to my wife, and what we're going to do is she's going to do traditions 1, 3, 5, and so forth, the odd ones. I'm going to do the even ones, and I want to get her up here anyway, because she needs, you need to know more about her, because she's a wonderful lady, and so come on up, sweetheart.
So are you guys having fun? All right. Well, now we're going to get into the good stuff. And that is the traditions and then traditions and relationships. And I'm telling you something, women, the best news I ever found out was that it's the good news and the bad news. And that is men and women are different. And that's the good news and the bad news. Now, the good news is I like some of the differences. The bad news is when I tried to make Dave fit into the emotions of a woman. And I'm really grateful today, thanks to this program, that I no longer have expectations of him to be something he cannot be. And I found out when it comes to sharing my feelings, I'd much rather talk to a woman anyway. So it's worked out fabulously. Okay, let's go with, I'm going to go over the tradition as it's written for the group, and then we're going to do the tradition and relationship. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. What we need to do is whatever we do is do it for the good of the whole. Other words, my personal opinion should not override the opinion of the whole. So what we are here for first is unity. Without unity, we have nothing. That's why that's the first tradition. It's like the first step. If we don't admit we're powerless over alcohol and our lives are unmanageable, there's no sense to go any further. We must first surrender to that. With the traditions, we first must be willing to look at the unity, the good of the all. I must put my personal opinions aside, and it must be for the good of the whole. Okay, we're going to go to tradition one for relationships. Our common welfare should come first. A healthy relationship depends upon unity. The very most important thing to be in a relationship, whether it's in a relationship with, for me, another man, or for whatever partnership you want, if it's to be with a job, whatever that relationship is, first, everybody needs to want to be in the relationship. There must be a unity. Now, one of the things that happens a lot of times when Dave and I have found this out by working with other people, that happens in some relationships, here's a man and a woman trying to come together, or we have also worked with lesbian and homosexual couples, but here's these relationships trying to come together, and there's no unity. It's my stuff, and there's rarely any our stuff. everything, they're still trying to operate as individuals. If you want to be in a relationship, there must be unity. There must be some type of unity. What's bringing you together? What brings us together as alcoholics, Al-Anon, and all the other 12-step programs? A common problem. That's what brings us the unity. Well, we need to have something that's going to bring us together. And a lot of times we say, well, love solves everything. Love does not solve everything, because most alcoholics don't have the faintest idea what love is. Love is about making me feel good. That is not love. That is not the definition of love. Love is an action. Love is really about trying to make another person feel good. We don't know about that yet. So what we have to have is a unity. And what Dave and I try to do is realize that we are Dave and Polly, and we're part of the whole. I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am a part of the whole. And what we're trying to do is do what is best for the marriage. So what that's going to require is a terrible word that alcoholics hate. And that word is compromise. That means I'm going to have to give up a little to your idea. You're going to have to give up a little to my idea. And we're going to have to do what's best for the relationship. So we need to have the unity. Sometimes that's not always true, because one of the things that I would do, and I'm much worse at it than Dave, Dave is very good about saying, our home, our kids, our car. I'm a little more on the my home, my car, my kids. But he's much better at it being the whole. And a lot of times what happens as a result of that is I will make decisions and do things that are good for me, include him, and he may not like it. But most of the time, because to save my face, because it would make me look very bad, he goes along with it. But those are the kind of nights we sit down at night and he says to me, I really wish you would have consulted me before volunteering me to things I don't want to do. So what I have to realize with that unity is I have to ever be mindful of what's, and considerate, another terrible word for an alcoholic, consideration of another person. I have to be considerate of my husband. And I have to stop and ask his opinion. And then if he says no, don't spend the next hour trying to convince him to do it my way. What we need to do is find a compromise. And that's what gets different. Because, see, I'm the kind of alcoholic that says, if you don't do it my way, I'm picking up my toys and going home. So now we have to learn to come to some agreement. So, and the same as in groups, we have to have the unity. And boy, sometimes going to a business meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous group, and it's really hard to find any unity. So thank God, you know, that we eventually get there. One of the things that we have to be is considerate in all areas. I have to consider Dave's emotions, his physical, his spiritual. These are the things that we have to be considerate in order to be able to work with the whole. So we have a checklist, and I'm going to kind of give you this checklist. And one of the things I want to say is this stuff does not happen overnight. At least it didn't for me. It takes practice. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we say action's the magic word. Now, I would love to just ask God to make me pure as the driven snow, a wonderful wife, and wake up and be that way. But what I believe God does for me is He helps me take the actions to make me a better partner. What am I willing to sacrifice for our relationship? There are some things I'm not willing to sacrifice. And the first and foremost thing I would never sacrifice for any relationship would be my sobriety. So a lot of times, that's why I say love is not the only answer. There are times when we love people, but we must let them go. Because to be in that relationship would be to destroy. So right now, I will sacrifice most anything for Dave because I love him. But the one thing I will not sacrifice for him is my sobriety. I will not be in a relationship at the expense of my sobriety. What effect do my actions have on our relationship and our family? One of the things that we sometimes do as alcoholics is we say, well, I'm hurting nobody but myself. That is just more self-centered bullshit. We do. Everything we do, especially when we have a partner in our life, my actions affect Dave. I can do things that would embarrass and hurt him. So I must be considerate of my actions and how they affect my husband. Am I a giver or a taker? And sometimes I have to think about that. Sometimes it just chokes right here. What would you like to do? And then when he tells me, be willing to do that. And we have a little joke around. Sometimes Dave will say, well, what would you like to do? And I'll make a suggestion. And then he'll say, well, how about we do da-da-da-da? And I'm like, a little while later, he says, well, did you want to do something? I said, no, I just made that suggestion just to be saying something. You know, then the little sarcasm, sometimes it just doesn't go away, you know. So these are the things we have to learn to do, is to come to these compromises. Am I a giver or am I a taker? Do I use silence as a refuge of punishment? Now that doesn't help the unity a lot. And one of the things that, and that works in the group as well, if your group is doing something that in your opinion, and it may be only your opinion at that particular time, that's going to affect the group as a whole, it is our responsibility to stand up for that. And one of the things that I believe in is if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. So if you have, stand up for that. Because, you know, without knowing it, our group may be going off astray and somehow would hurt AA as a whole. So I have to stand up for that. The same in my relationship. There are times I need to say, this is really important to me. And I believe we need to sit and talk about this. And huffing off into a fit of anger will not solve it. We have to find a way to talk through it. And it's really hard to be an adult and do that. Because I have the reactions of a child. I want to do it my way. I don't want to have to sit down and talk it through. Do I listen when my mate has something to say? That's hard. Especially when I know he's dead wrong. Do I admire and approve of my mate? I do. Am I healing, mending, intricate force in our marriage, or am I decisive? What I try to do is, it's every day I try to ask God to help me to be a good partner in my marriage. Not a dictator or a leader, a partner. And for a self-centered, self-seeking alcoholic, sometimes that's very difficult. Am I a peacemaker? And one of the things is sometimes I have to watch that because I can be a peacemaker to the extent of being dishonest. I will want no conflict, so I will be a peacemaker. And then because I gave in and didn't tell the truth and didn't let Dave know how I really felt about something, I end up being resentful. That doesn't help the marriage either. So again, it's being honest, that honesty, but not the kind of honesty that you take and beat a person to death with. To try to say, this is how I feel, and then try to come to a compromise about it. And one of the toughest things that happens with alcoholics that we need to learn how to do is, am I flexible? We are very rigid people. That's why it sometimes is so hard to get things going in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have this statement is that we've always done it this way. Well, maybe it's time, like Dave said, for a change. And the other thing is somebody often says in relationships, you're supposed to tell Dave everything. I disagree with that. I need to tell my sponsor everything, but I don't necessarily need to tell Dave everything. Because, you know, some of my thoughts and some of the things that I feel, if I told him, would be very harmful to him. So I have to, it's okay for me to have those little secrets if they're going to hurt him, as long as they don't damage the relationship as a whole. Now, I have no secrets, thoughts or otherwise, from my AA sponsor. She's the person who knows me entirely. But it's not necessary that Dave does. Sometimes it's just okay to let him have his boy thoughts and me to have my girl thoughts. And sometimes they just don't need to come together. Tradition 2.